60 miles an hour. Even if it was only a little off course, with that speed and time, Brian might now be sitting several hundred miles off to the side of the recorded flight plan. And they would probably search most heavily at first along the flight plan course. They might go out to the side a little, but he could easily be 300-400 miles to the side. He could not know, could not think of how far he might have flown wrong, because he didn't know the original course, and didn't know how much they had pulled sideways. Quite a bit, that's how he remembered it. Quite a jerk to the side. It pulled his head over sharply when the plane had swung around. They might not find him for 2 or 3 days. He felt his heartbeat increase as the fear started. The thought was there, but he fought it down for a time, pushed it away, then it exploded out. They might not find him for a long time. And the next thought was there as well, that they might never find him. But that was panic, and he fought it down and tried to stay positive. They searched hard when a plane went down. They used many men and planes, and they would go to the side. They would know he was off from the flight path. He had talked to the man on the radio. They would somehow know. It would be all right. They would find him. Maybe not tomorrow, but soon. 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 They would find him soon. Gradually, like sloshing oil, his thoughts settled back and the panic was gone. Say they didn't come for 2 days. No, say they didn't come for 3 days. Even push that to 4 days. He could live with that. He'd have to live with that. He didn't want to think of them taking longer. But say 4 days. He had to do something. He couldn't just sit at the bottom of this tree and stare down at the lake for 4 days. And nights. He was in deep woods and didn't have any matches, couldn't make a fire. There were large things in the woods. There were wolves, he thought, and bears, other things. In the dark, he would be in the open here, just sitting at the bottom of a tree. He looked around suddenly, felt the hair on the back of his neck go up. Things might be looking at him right now, waiting for him, waiting for dark so they could move in and take him. He fingered the hatchet at his belt. It was the only weapon he had, but it was something. He had to have some kind of shelter. No, make that more. He had to have some kind of shelter, and he had to have something to eat. He pulled himself to his feet and jerked the back of his shirt down before the mosquitoes could get at it. He had to do something to help himself. I have to get motivated, he thought, remembering Perpich. Right now, I'm all I've got. I have to do something. Two years before, he and Terry had been fooling around down near the park, where the city seemed to end for a time and the trees grew thick and came down to the small river that went through the park. It was thick there and seemed kind of wild, and they had been joking and making things up, and they pretended that they were lost in the woods and talked in the afternoon about what they would do. Of course, they figured they'd have all sorts of goodies like a gun and a knife and fishing gear and matches so they could hunt and fish and have a fire. I wish you were here, Terry, he thought, with a gun and a knife and some matches. In the park that time, they had decided the best shelter was a lean-to, and Brian set out now to make one up. Maybe cover it with grass or leaves or sticks, he thought, and he started to go down to the lake again, where there were some willows he could cut down for braces. But it struck him that he ought to find a good place for the lean-to, and so he decided to look around first. He wanted to stay near the lake because he thought the plane, even deep in the water, might show up to somebody flying over, and he didn't want to diminish any chance he might have of being found. His eyes fell upon the stone ridge to his left, and he thought at first he should build his shelter against the stone. But before that, he decided to check out the far side of the ridge, and that was where he got lucky. Using the sun and the fact that it rose in the east and set in the west, he decided that the far side was the northern side of the ridge. At one time in the far past, it had been scooped by something, probably a glacier, and this scooping had left a kind of sideways bowl back in under a ledge. It wasn't very deep, not a cave, but it was smooth and made a perfect roof, and he could almost stand in under the ledge. He had to hold his head slightly tipped forward at the front to keep it from hitting the top. Some of the rock that had been scooped out had also been pulverized by the glacial action, turned into sand, and now made a small sand beach that went down to the edge of the water in front and to the right of the overhang. It was his first good luck. No, he thought. He had good luck in the landing. But this was good luck as well, luck he needed. All he had to do was wall off part of the bowl and leave an opening as a doorway, and he would have a perfect shelter, much stronger than a lean-to and dry because the overhang made a watertight roof. He crawled back in under the ledge and sat. The sand was cool here in the shade, and the coolness felt wonderful to his face, which was already starting to blister and get especially painful on his forehead, with the blisters on top of the swelling. He was also still weak. Just the walk around the back of the ridge and the slight climb over the top had left his legs rubbery. It felt good to sit for a bit under the shade of the overhang in the cool sand. And now, he thought, if I just had something to eat. Anything. When he had rested a bit, he went back down to the lake and drank a couple of swallows of water. He wasn't all that thirsty, but he thought the water might help to take the edge off his hunger. It didn't. Somehow the cold lake water actually made it worse, sharpened it. He thought of dragging in wood to make a wall on part of the overhang, and picked up one piece to pull up, but his arms were too weak, and he knew then that it wasn't just the crash and injury to his body and head. It was also that he was weak from hunger. He would have to find something to eat. Before he did anything else, he would have to have something to eat. But what? Brian leaned against the rock and stared out at the lake. What in all of this was there to eat? He was so used to having food just be there, just always being there. When he was hungry, he went to the icebox or to the store or sat down at a meal his mother cooked. Oh, he thought, remembering a meal now. Oh. It was the last Thanksgiving, last year, the last Thanksgiving they had as a family before his mother demanded the divorce and his father moved out in the following January. Brian already knew the secret, but did not know it would cause them to break up, and thought it might work out, the secret that his father still did not know, but that he would try to tell him when he saw him. The meal had been turkey, and they cooked it in the backyard in the barbecue over charcoal with the lid down tight. His father had put hickory chips on the charcoal, and the smell of the cooking turkey and the hickory smoke had filled the yard. When his father took the lid off, smiling, the smell that had come out was unbelievable. And when they sat to eat, the meat was wet with juice and rich and had the taste of the smoke in it. He had to stop this. His mouth was full of saliva and his stomach was twisting and growling. What was there to eat? What had he read or seen that told him about food in the wilderness? Hadn't there been something? A show. Yes, a show on television about Air Force pilots and some kind of course they took. A survival course. All right, he had the show coming into his thoughts now. The pilots had to live in the desert. They put them in the desert down in Arizona or someplace, and they had to live for a week. They had to find food and water for a week. For water, they had made a sheet of plastic into a dew-gathering device, and for food, they ate lizards. That was it. Of course, Brian had lots of water, and there weren't too many lizards in the Canadian woods, that he knew. One of the pilots had used a watch crystal as a magnifying glass to focus the sun and start a fire so they didn't have to eat the lizards raw. But Brian had a digital watch without a crystal, broken at that, so the show didn't help him much. Wait, there was one thing. One of the pilots, a woman, had found some kind of beans on a bush, and she had used them with her lizard meat to make a little stew in a tin can she had found. Bean lizard stew. There weren't any beans here, but there must be berries. There had to be berry bushes around. Sure, the woods were full of berry bushes. That's what everybody always said. Well, he'd actually never heard anybody say it, but he felt that it should be true. There must be berry bushes. He stood and moved out into the sand and looked up at the sun. It was still high. He didn't know what time it must be. At home, it would be 1 or 2 if the sun were that high. At home, at 1 or 2, his mother would be putting away the lunch dishes and getting ready for her exercise class. No, that would have been yesterday. Today she would be going to see him. Today was Thursday, and she always went to see him on Thursdays. Wednesday was the exercise class, and Thursday she went to see him. Hot little jets of hate worked into his thoughts, pushed once, moved back. If his mother hadn't begun to see him and forced the divorce, Brian wouldn't be here now. He shook his head, had to stop that kind of thinking. The sun was still high, and that meant that he had some time before darkness to find berries. He didn't want to be away from his—he almost thought of it as home—shelter when it came to be dark. He didn't want to be anywhere in the woods when it came to be dark. And he didn't want to get lost, which was a real problem. All he knew in the world was the lake in front of him and the hill at his back and the ridge. If he lost sight of them, there was a really good chance that he would get turned around and not find his way back. So he had to look for berry bushes, but keep the lake or the rock ridge in sight at all times. He looked up the lake shore to the north. For a good distance, perhaps 200 yards, it was fairly clear. There were tall pines, the kind with no limbs until very close to the top, with a gentle breeze sighing in them, but not too much low brush. 200 yards up, there seemed to be a belt of thick lower brush starting, about 10 or 12 feet high, and that formed a wall he could not see through. It seemed to go on around the lake, thick and lushly green, but he could not be sure. If there were berries, they would be in that brush, he felt, and as long as he stayed close to the lake so he could keep the water on his right and know it was there, he wouldn't get lost. When he was done or found berries, he thought, he would just turn around so the water was on his left and walk back until he came to the ridge and his shelter. Simple. Keep it simple. I am Brian Robeson. I have been in a plane crash. I'm going to find some food. I'm going to find berries. He walked slowly, still a bit pained in his joints and weak from hunger, up along the side of the lake. The trees were full of birds singing ahead of him in the sun. Some he knew, some he didn't. He saw a robin and some kind of sparrows and a flock of reddish-orange birds with thick beaks. 20 or 30 of them were sitting in one of the pines. They made much noise and flew away ahead of him when he walked under the tree. He watched them fly, their color a bright slash in solid green, and in this way he found the berries. The birds landed in some taller willow type of undergrowth with wide leaves and started jumping and making noise. At first he was too far away to see what they were doing, but their color drew him, and he moved toward them, keeping the lake in sight on his right, and when he got closer, he saw they were eating berries. He could not believe it was that easy. It was as if the birds had taken him right to the berries. The slender branches went up about 20 feet and were heavy, drooping with clusters of bright red berries. They were half as big as grapes, but hung in bunches, much like grapes, and when Brian saw them glistening red in the sunlight, he almost yelled. His pace quickened, and he was in them in moments, scattering the birds, grabbing branches, stripping them to fill his mouth with berries. He almost spit them out. It wasn't that they were bitter so much as that they lacked any sweetness, had a tart flavor that left his mouth dry feeling. And they were like cherries in that they had large pits which made them hard to chew. But there was such a hunger on him, such an emptiness, that he could not stop, and kept stripping branches and eating berries by the handful, grabbing and jamming them into his mouth and swallowing them, pits and all. He could not stop, and when at last his stomach was full, he was still hungry. 2 days without food must have shrunken his stomach, but the drive of hunger was still there. Thinking of the birds and how they would come back into the berries when he left, he made a carrying pouch of his torn windbreaker and kept picking. Finally, when he judged he had close to 4 pounds in the jacket, he stopped and went back to his camp by the ridge. Now, he thought, now I have some food, and I can do something about fixing this place up. He glanced at the sun and saw he had some time before dark. If only I had matches, he thought, looking ruefully at the beach and lakeside. There is driftwood everywhere, not to mention dead and dry wood all over the hill and dead dry branches hanging from every tree. All firewood and no matches. How did they used to do it, he thought. Rub 2 sticks together? He tucked the berries in the pouch back in under the overhang in the cool shade and found a couple of sticks. After 10 minutes of rubbing, he felt the sticks and they were almost cool to the touch. Not that, he thought. They didn't do fire that way. He threw the sticks down in disgust. So no fire. But he could still fix the shelter and make it. Here the word safer came into his mind, and he didn't know why, more livable. Kind of close it in, he thought. I'll just close it in a bit. He started dragging sticks up from the lake and pulling long dead branches down from the hill, never getting out of sight of the water and the ridge. With these he interlaced and wove a wall across the opening of the front of the rock. It took over 2 hours, and he had to stop several times because he still felt a bit weak, and once because he felt a strange new twinge in his stomach. A tightening rolling. Too many berries, he thought. I ate too many of them. But it was gone soon, and he kept working until the entire front of the overhang was covered, save for a small opening at the right end nearest the lake. The doorway was about 3 feet, and when he went in, he found himself in a room almost 15 feet long and 8 to 10 feet deep, with the rock wall sloping down at the rear. "Good," he said, nodding. "Good." Outside, the sun was going down finally, and in the initial coolness, the mosquitoes came out again and clouded in on him. They were thick, terrible, if not quite as bad as in the morning, and he kept brushing them off his arms until he couldn't stand it, and then dumped the berries and put the torn windbreaker on. At least the sleeves covered his arms. Wrapped in the jacket, with darkness coming down fast now, he crawled back in under the rock and huddled and tried to sleep. He was deeply tired and still aching some, but sleep was slow coming and did not finally settle in until the evening cool turned to night cool and the mosquitoes slowed. Then, at last, with his stomach turning on the berries, Brian went to sleep. "Mother!" He screamed it, and he could not be sure if the scream awakened him or the pain in his stomach. His whole abdomen was torn with great rolling jolts of pain, pain that doubled him in the darkness of the little shelter, put him over and face down in the sand to moan again and again, "Mother, mother, mother." Never anything like this, never. It was as if all the berries, all the pits had exploded in the center of him, ripped and tore at him. He crawled out the doorway and was sick in the sand, then crawled still farther and was sick again, vomiting and with terrible diarrhea for over an hour, for over a year, he thought, until he was at last empty and drained of all strength. Then he crawled back into the shelter and fell again to the sand, but could not sleep at first, could do nothing except lie there, and his mind decided then to bring the memory up again. In the mall. Every detail. His mother sitting in the station wagon with the man. And she had leaned across and kissed him. Kissed the man with the short blonde hair. And it was not a friendly peck, but a kiss. A kiss where she turned her head over at an angle and put her mouth against the mouth of the blonde man who was not his father and kissed, mouth to mouth, and then brought her hand up to touch his cheek, his forehead, while they were kissing. And Brian saw it. Saw this thing that his mother did with the blonde man. Saw the kiss that became the secret that his father still did not know about, know all about. The memory was so real that he could feel the heat in the mall that day. Could remember the worry that Terry would turn and see his mother. Could remember the worry of the shame of it. And then the memory faded and he slept again. Awake. For a second, perhaps two, he did not know where he was. Was still in his sleep somewhere. Then he saw the sun streaming in the open doorway of the shelter and heard the close, vicious whine of the mosquitoes and knew. He brushed his face, completely welted now with 2 days of bites, completely covered with lumps and bites, and was surprised to find the swelling on his forehead had gone down a great deal, was almost gone. The smell was awful, and he couldn't place it. Then he saw the pile of berries at the back of the shelter and remembered the night and being sick. "Too many of them," he said aloud. "Too many gut cherries." He crawled out of the shelter and found where he'd messed the sand. He used sticks and cleaned it as best he could, covered it with clean sand, and went down to the lake to wash his hands and get a drink. It was still very early, only just past true dawn, and the water was so calm he could see his reflection. It frightened him. The face was cut and bleeding, swollen and lumpy, the hair all matted, and on his forehead a cut had healed, but left the hair stuck with blood and scab. His eyes were slits in the bites, and he was, somehow, covered with dirt. He slapped the water with his hand to destroy the mirror. Ugly, he thought. Very, very ugly. And he was at that moment almost overcome with self-pity. He was dirty and starving and bitten and hurt and lonely and ugly and afraid and so completely miserable that it was like being in a pit, a dark, deep pit with no way out. He sat back on the bank and fought, crying, then let it come, and cried for perhaps 3-4 minutes, long tears, self-pity tears, wasted tears. He stood, went back to the water, and took small drinks. As soon as the cold water hit his stomach, he felt the hunger sharpen as it had before, and he stood and held his abdomen until the hunger cramps receded. He had to eat. He was weak with it again, down with the hunger, and he had to eat. Back at the shelter, the berries lay in a pile where he had dumped them when he grabbed his windbreaker. Gut cherries, he called them in his mind now, and he thought of eating some of them. Not such a crazy amount as he had, which he felt brought on the sickness in the night, but just enough to stave off the hunger a bit. He crawled into the shelter. Some flies were on the berries, and he brushed them off. He selected only the berries that were solidly ripe, not the light red ones, but the berries that were dark, maroon red to black, and swollen in ripeness. When he had a small handful of them, he went back down to the lake and washed them in the water. Small fish scattered away when he splashed the water up, and he wished he had a fishing line and hook. Then he ate them carefully, spitting out the pits. They were still tart, but had a sweetness to them, although they seemed to make his lips a bit numb. When he finished, he was still hungry, but the edge was gone, and his legs didn't feel as weak as they had. He went back to the shelter. It took him half an hour to go through the rest of the berries and sort them, putting all the fully ripe ones in a pile on some leaves, the rest in another pile. When he was done, he covered the two piles with grass he tore from the lake shore to keep the flies off, and went back outside. They were awful berries, those gut cherries, he thought, but there was food there, food of some kind, and he could eat a bit more later tonight if he had to. For now he had a full day ahead of him. He looked at the sky through the trees and saw that while there were clouds, they were scattered and did not seem to hold rain. There was a light breeze that seemed to keep the mosquitoes down, and he thought, looking up along the lake shore, if there was one kind of berry, there should be other kinds, sweeter kinds. If he kept the lake in sight as he had done yesterday, he should be all right, should be able to find home again, and it stopped him. He had actually thought it that time. Home. 3 days? No, two. Or was it three? Yes, this was the third day, and he had thought of the shelter as home. He turned and looked at it, studied the crude work. The brush made a fair wall, not weathertight, but it cut most of the wind off. He hadn't done so badly at that. Maybe it wasn't much, but also maybe it was all he had for a home. All right, he thought, so I'll call it home. He turned back and set off up the side of the lake, heading for the gut cherry bushes, his windbreaker bag in his hand. Things were bad, he thought, but maybe not that bad. Maybe he could find some better berries. When he came to the gut cherry bushes, he paused. The branches were empty of birds, but still had many berries, and some of those that had been merely red yesterday were now a dark maroon to black, much riper. Maybe he should stay and pick them to save them. But the explosion in the night was still much in his memory, and he decided to go on. Gut cherries were food, but tricky to eat. He needed something better. Another 100 yards up the shore, there was a place where the wind had torn another path. These must have been fierce winds, he thought, to tear places up like this, as they had the path he had found with the plane when he crashed. Here the trees were not all the way down, but twisted and snapped off halfway up from the ground, so their tops were all down and rotted and gone, leaving the snags poking into the sky like broken teeth. It made for tons of dead and dry wood, and he wished once more he could get a fire going. It also made a kind of clearing. With the tops of the trees gone, the sun could get down to the ground, and it was filled with small, thorny bushes that were covered with berries. Raspberries. These he knew, because there were some raspberry bushes in the park, and he and Terry were always picking and eating them when they biked past. The berries were full and ripe, and he tasted one to find it sweet, and with none of the problems of the gut cherries. Although they did not grow in clusters, there were many of them, and they were easy to pick, and Brian smiled and started eating. Sweet juice, he thought. Oh, they were sweet, with just a tiny tang, and he picked and ate and picked and ate and thought that he had never tasted anything this good. Soon, as before, his stomach was full, but now he had some sense and he did not gorge or cram more down. Instead, he picked more and put them in his windbreaker, feeling the morning sun on his back and thinking he was rich, rich with food now, just rich. And he heard a noise to his rear, a slight noise, and he turned and saw the bear. He could do nothing, think nothing. His tongue, stained with berry juice, stuck to the roof of his mouth, and he stared at the bear. It was black, with a cinnamon-colored nose not 20 feet from him, and big. No, huge. It was all black fur and huge. He had seen one in the zoo in the city once, a black bear, but it had been from India or somewhere. This one was wild and much bigger than the one in the zoo, and it was right there. Right there. The sun caught the ends of the hairs along his back. Shining, black, and silky, the bear stood on its hind legs, half up, and studied Brian. Just studied him, then lowered itself and moved slowly to the left, eating berries as it rolled along, waffling and delicately using its mouth to lift each berry from the stem, and in seconds it was gone. Gone, and Brian still had not moved. His tongue was stuck to the top of his mouth, the tip half out, his eyes were wide, and his hands were reaching for a berry. Then he made a sound, a low... It made no sense. It was just a sound of fear, of disbelief, that something that large could have come so close to him without his knowing. It just walked up to him and could have eaten him, and he could have done nothing, nothing. And when the sound was half done, a thing happened with his legs, a thing he had nothing to do with, and they were running in the opposite direction from the bear, back toward the shelter. He would have run all the way in panic, but after he had gone perhaps 50 yards, his brain took over and slowed and finally stopped him. If the bear had wanted you, his brain said, he would have taken you. It's something to understand, he thought, not something to run away from. The bear was eating berries, not people. The bear made no move to hurt you, to threaten you. It stood to see you better, study you, then went on its way, eating berries. It was a big bear, but it did not want you, did not want to cause you harm, and that is the thing to understand here. He turned and looked back at the stand of raspberries. The bear was gone. The birds were singing. He saw nothing that could hurt him. There was no danger here that he could sense, could feel. In the city, at night, there was sometimes danger. You could not be in the park at night after dark because of the danger. But here, the bear had looked at him and had moved on. And this filled his thoughts. The berries were so good. So good. So sweet and rich, and his body was so empty. And the bear had almost indicated that it didn't mind sharing, had just walked from him. And the berries were so good. And he thought finally, if he did not go back and get the berries, he would have to eat the gut cherries again tonight. That convinced him, and he walked slowly back to the raspberry patch and continued picking for the entire morning, although with great caution. And once when a squirrel rustled some pine needles at the base of a tree, he nearly jumped out of his skin. About noon, the sun was almost straight overhead. The clouds began to thicken and look dark. In moments it started to rain, and he took what he had picked and trotted back to the shelter. He had eaten probably 2 pounds of raspberries and had maybe another 3 pounds in his jacket rolled in a pouch. He made it to shelter just as the clouds completely opened and the rain roared down in sheets. Soon the sand outside was drenched and there were rivulets running down to the lake. But inside he was dry and snug. He started to put the picked berries back in the sorted pile with the gut cherries, but noticed that the raspberries were seeping through the jacket. They were much softer than the gut cherries and apparently were being crushed a bit with their own weight. When he held the jacket up and looked beneath it, he saw a stream of red liquid. He put a finger in it and found it to be sweet and tangy, like pop without the fizz, and he grinned and lay back on the sand, holding the bag up over his face and letting the seepage drip into his mouth. Outside, the rain poured down, but Brian lay back, drinking the syrup from the berries, dry and with the pain almost gone, the stiffness also gone, his belly full and a good taste in his mouth. For the first time since the crash, he was not thinking of himself, of his own life. Brian was wondering if the bear was as surprised as he to find another being in the berries. Later in the afternoon, as evening came down, he went to the lake and washed the sticky berry juice from his face and hands, then went back to prepare for the night. While he had accepted and understood that the bear did not want to hurt him, it was still much in his thoughts, and as darkness came into the shelter, he took the hatchet out of his belt and put it by his head, his hand on the handle, as the day caught up with him, and he slept. At first he thought it was a growl. In the still darkness of the shelter in the middle of the night, his eyes came open, and he was awake, and he thought there was a growl. But it was the wind. A medium wind in the pines had made some sound that brought him up, brought him awake. He sat up and was hit with the smell. It terrified him. The smell was one of rot. some musty rot that made him think only of graves with cobwebs and dust and old death. His nostrils widened and he opened his eyes wider, but he could see nothing. It was too dark, too hard dark, with clouds covering even the small light from the stars, and he could not see. But the smell was alive, alive and full and in the shelter. He thought of the bear, thought of Bigfoot and every monster he had ever seen in every fright movie he had ever watched, and his heart hammered in his throat. Then he heard the slithering, a brushing sound, a slithering, brushing sound near his feet, and he kicked out as hard as he could, kicked out and threw the hatchet at the sound, a noise coming from his throat. But the hatchet missed, sailed into the wall where it hit the rocks with a shower of sparks, and his leg was instantly torn with pain, as if 100 needles had been driven into it. Ah! Now he screamed with the pain and fear and skittered on his backside up into the corner of the shelter, breathing through his mouth, straining to see, to hear. The slithering moved again. He thought toward him at first, and terror took him, stopping his breath. He felt he could see a low, dark form, a bulk in the darkness, a shadow that lived. But now it moved away. Slithering and scraping, it moved away, and he saw or thought he saw it go out of the door opening. He lay on his side for a moment, then pulled a rasping breath in and held it, listening for the attacker to return. When it was apparent that the shadow wasn't coming back, he felt the calf of his leg where the pain was centered and spreading to fill the whole leg. His fingers gingerly touched a group of needles that had been driven through his pants and into the fleshy part of his calf. They were stiff and very sharp on the ends that stuck out, and he knew then what the attacker had been. A porcupine had stumbled into his shelter, and when he had kicked it, the thing had slapped him with its tail of quills. He touched each quill carefully. The pain made it seem as if dozens of them had been slammed into his leg, but there were only 8, pinning the cloth against his skin. He leaned back against the wall for a minute. He couldn't leave them in, they had to come out, but just touching them made the pain more intense. So fast, he thought, so fast things change. When he'd gone to sleep, he had satisfaction, and in just a moment it was all different. He grasped one of the quills, held his breath, and jerked. It sent pain signals to his brain in tight waves, but he grabbed another, pulled it, then another quill. When he had pulled 4 of them, he stopped for a moment. The pain had gone from being a pointed injury pain to spreading in a hot smear up his leg, and it made him catch his breath. Some of the quills were driven in deeper than others, and they tore when they came out. He breathed deeply twice, let half of the breath out, and went back to work. Jerk. Pause. Jerk. And 3 more times before he lay back in the darkness. Done. The pain filled his leg now, and with it came new waves of self-pity. Sitting alone in the dark, his leg aching, some mosquitoes finding him again, he started crying. It was all too much, just too much, and he couldn't take it. Not the way it was. I can't take it this way, alone with no fire and in the dark. And next time it might be something worse, maybe a bear, and it wouldn't be just quills in the leg, it would be worse. I can't do this, he thought, again and again. I can't. Brian pulled himself up until he was sitting upright back in the corner of the cave. He put his head down on his arms across his knees with stiffness taking his left leg and cried until he was cried out. He did not know how long it took, but later he looked back on this time of crying in the corner of the dark cave and thought of it as when he learned the most important rule of survival, which was that feeling sorry for yourself didn't work. It wasn't just that it was wrong to do or that it was considered incorrect. It was more than that. It didn't work. When he sat alone in the darkness and cried and was done, was all done with it, nothing had changed. His legs still hurt, it was still dark, he was still alone, and the self-pity had accomplished nothing. At last he slept again, but already his patterns were changing, and the sleep was light, a resting doze more than a deep sleep, with small sounds awakening him twice in the rest of the night. In the last doze period before daylight, before he awakened finally with the morning light and the clouds of new mosquitoes, he dreamed. This time it was not of his mother, not of the secret, but of his father at first and then of his friend Terry. In the initial segment of the dream, his father was standing at the side of a living room looking at him, and it was clear from his expression that he was trying to tell Brian something. His lips moved, but there was no sound, not a whisper. He waved his hands at Brian, made gestures in front of his face as if he were scratching something, and he worked to make a word with his mouth, but at first Brian could not see it. Then the lips made an mmm shape, but no sound came. Mmm-ma. Brian could not hear it, could not understand it, and he wanted to so badly. It was so important to understand his father, to know what he was saying. He was trying to help. He was trying so hard. And when Brian couldn't understand, he looked cross, the way he did when Brian asked questions more than once, and he faded. Brian's father faded into a fog place Brian could not see, and the dream was almost over, or seemed to be, when Terry came. He was not gesturing to Brian, but was sitting in the park, at a bench, looking at a barbecue pit, and for a time nothing happened. Then he got up and poured some charcoal from a bag into the cooker, then some lighter fluid, and he took a flick type of lighter and lit the fluid. When it was burning and the charcoal was at last getting hot, he turned, noticing Brian for the first time in the dream. He turned and smiled and pointed to the fire as if to say, "See? A fire." But it meant nothing to Brian, except that he wished he had a fire. He saw a grocery sack on the table next to Terry. Brian thought it must contain hot dogs and chips and mustard, and he could think only of the food. But Terry shook his head and pointed again to the fire, and twice more he pointed to the fire, made Brian see the flames, and Brian felt his frustration and anger rise, and he thought, all right, I see the fire, but so what? I don't have a fire. I know about fire. I know I need a fire. I know that. His eyes opened, and there was light in the cave, a gray, dim light of morning. He wiped his mouth and tried to move his leg, which had stiffened like wood. There was thirst and hunger, and he ate some raspberries from the jacket. They had spoiled a bit, seemed softer and mushier, but still had a rich sweetness. He crushed the berries against the roof of his mouth with his tongue and drank the sweet juice as it ran down his throat. A flash of metal caught his eye, and he saw his hatchet in the sand where he had thrown it at the porcupine in the dark. He scooched up, wincing a bit when he bent his stiff leg and crawled to where the hatchet lay. He picked it up and examined it and saw a chip in the top of the head. The nick wasn't large, but the hatchet was important to him, was his only tool, and he should not have thrown it. He should keep it in his hand and make a tool of some kind to help push an animal away. Make a staff, he thought, or a lance, and save the hatchet. Something came then. A thought as he held the hatchet, something about the dream and his father and Terry, but he couldn't pin it down. Ah! He scrambled out and stood in the morning sun and stretched his back muscles and his sore leg. The hatchet was still in his hand, and as he stretched and raised it over his head, it caught the first rays of the morning sun. The first faint light hit the silver of the hatchet, and it flashed a brilliant gold in the light, like fire. That is it, he thought. What they were trying to tell me. Fire. The hatchet was the key to it all. When he threw the hatchet at the porcupine in the cave and missed and hit the stone wall, it had showered sparks, a golden shower of sparks in the dark, as golden with fire as the sun was now. The hatchet was the answer. That's what his father and Terry had been trying to tell him. Somehow he could get fire from the hatchet. The sparks would make fire. Brian went back into the shelter and studied the wall. It was some form of chalky granite or a sandstone, but embedded in it were large pieces of a darker stone, a harder and darker stone. It only took him a moment to find where the hatchet had struck. The steel had nicked into the edge of one of the darker stone pieces. Brian turned the head backward so he would strike with the flat rear of the hatchet and hit the black rock gently. Too gently, and nothing happened. He struck harder, a glancing blow, and two or three weak sparks skipped off the rock and died immediately. He swung harder, held the hatchet so it would hit a longer sliding blow, and the black rock exploded in fire. Sparks flew so heavily that several of them skittered and jumped on the sand beneath the rock, and he smiled and struck again and again. There could be fire here, he thought. I will have a fire here, he thought, and struck again. I will have fire from the hatchet. Brian found it was a long way from sparks to fire. Clearly there had to be something for the sparks to ignite, some kind of tinder or kindling, but what? He brought some dried grass in, tapped sparks into it, and watched them die. He tried small twigs, breaking them into little pieces, but that was worse than the grass. Then he tried a combination of the two, grass and twigs. Nothing. He had no trouble getting sparks, but the tiny bits of hot stone or metal, he couldn't tell which they were, just sputtered and died. He settled back on his haunches in exasperation, looking at the pitiful clump of grass and twigs. He needed something finer, something soft and fine and fluffy to catch the bits of fire. Shredded paper would be nice, but he had no paper. "So close," he said aloud. "So close." He put the hatchet back in his belt and went out of the shelter, limping on a sore leg. There had to be something, had to be. Man had made fire. There had been fire for thousands, millions of years. There had to be a way. He dug in his pockets and found the $20 bill in his wallet. Paper. Worthless paper out here. But if he could get a fire going... He ripped the 20 into tiny pieces, made a pile of pieces and hit sparks into them. Nothing happened. They just wouldn't take the sparks. But there had to be a way, some way to do it. Not 20 feet to his right, leaning out over the water, were birches. And he stood looking at them for a full half minute before they registered on his mind. They were a beautiful white, with bark like clean, slightly speckled paper. Paper. He moved to the trees. Where the bark was peeling from the trunks, it lifted in tiny tendrils, almost fluffs. Brian plucked some of them loose, rolled them in his fingers. They seemed flammable, dry and nearly powdery. He pulled and twisted bits off the trees, packing them in one hand while he picked them with the other, picking and gathering until he had a wad close to the size of a baseball. Then he went back into the shelter and arranged the ball of birch bark peelings at the base of the black rock. As an afterthought, he threw in the remains of the $20 bill. He struck, and a stream of sparks fell into the bark and quickly died. But this time, one spark fell on one small hair of dry bark, almost a thread of bark, and seemed to glow a bit brighter before it died. The material had to be finer. There had to be a soft and incredibly fine nest for the sparks. "I must make a home for the sparks," he thought. "A perfect home, or they won't stay. They won't make fire." He started ripping the bark, using his fingernails at first, and when that didn't work, he used the sharp edge of the hatchet, cutting the bark in thin slivers, hairs so fine they were almost not there. It was painstaking work, slow work, and he stayed with it for over 2 hours. Twice he stopped for a handful of berries and once to go to the lake for a drink, then back to work. The sun on his back, until at last he had a ball of fluff as big as a grapefruit, dry birch bark fluff. He positioned his spark nest, as he thought of it, at the base of the rock, used his thumb to make a small depression in the middle, and slammed the back of the hatchet down across the black rock. A cloud of sparks rained down, most of them missing the nest, but some, perhaps 30 or so, hit in the depression, and of those 6 or 7 found fuel and grew, smoldered and caused the bark to take on the red glow. Then they went out. Close. He was close. He repositioned the nest, made a new and smaller dent with his thumb, and struck again. More sparks, a slight glow, then nothing. "It's me," he thought. "I'm doing something wrong. I do not know this. A cave dweller would have had a fire by now. A Cro-Magnon man would have a fire by now, but I don't know this. I don't know how to make a fire. Maybe not enough sparks." He settled the nest in place once more and hit the rock with a series of blows as fast as he could. The sparks poured like a golden waterfall. At first they seemed to take. There were several, many sparks that found life and took briefly, but they all died. Starved. He leaned back. "They're like me. They are starving. It wasn't quantity. There were plenty of sparks, but they needed more. I would kill," he thought suddenly, "for a book of matches. Just one book. Just one match I would kill. What makes fire?" He thought back to school, to all those science classes. Had he ever learned what made a fire? Did a teacher ever stand up there and say, "This is what makes a fire"? He shook his head, tried to focus his thoughts. What did it take? You have to have fuel, he thought, and he had that. The bark was fuel. Oxygen. There had to be air. He needed to add air. He had to fan on it, blow on it. He made the nest ready again, held the hatchet backward, tensed, and struck 4 quick blows. Sparks came down, and he leaned forward as fast as he could and blew. Too hard. There was a bright, almost intense glow, then it was gone. He'd blown it out. Another set of strikes, more sparks. He leaned and blew, but gently this time, holding back and aiming the stream of air from his mouth to hit the brightest spot. 5 or 6 sparks had fallen in a tight mass of bark hair, and Brian centered his efforts there. The sparks grew with his gentle breath. The red glow moved from the sparks themselves into the bark, moved and grew and became worms, glowing red worms that crawled up the bark hairs and caught other threads of bark and grew until there was a pocket of red as big as a quarter, a glowing red coal of heat. And when he ran out of breath and paused to inhale, the red ball suddenly burst into flame. "Fire!" he yelled. "I've got fire! I've got it! I've got it! I've got it!" But the flames were thick and oily and burning fast, consuming the ball of bark as fast as if it were gasoline. He had to feed the flames, keep them going. Working as fast as he could, he carefully placed the dried grass and wood pieces he had tried at first on top of the bark and was gratified to see them take. But they would go fast. He needed more and more. He could not let the flames go out. He ran from the shelter to the pines and started breaking off the low, dead, small limbs. These he threw in the shelter, went back for more, threw those in and squatted to break and feed the hungry flames. When the small wood was going well, he went out and found larger wood and did not relax until that was going. Then he leaned back against the wood brace of his door opening and smiled. "I have a friend," he thought. "I have a friend now. A hungry friend, but a good one. I have a friend named Fire. Hello, Fire." The curve of the rock back made an almost perfect drawing flue that carried the smoke up through the cracks of the roof but held the heat. If he kept the fire small, it would be perfect and would keep anything like the porcupine from coming through the door again. A friend and a guard, he thought. So much from a little spark, a friend and a guard from a tiny spark. He looked around and wished he had somebody to tell this thing, to show this thing he had done. But there was nobody. Nothing but the trees and the sun and the breeze and the lake. Nobody. And he thought, rolling thoughts, with the smoke curling up over his head and the smile still half on his face, he thought, "I wonder what they're doing now. I wonder what my father's doing now. I wonder what my mother's doing now. I wonder if she's with him." He could not at first leave the fire. It was so precious to him, so close and sweet a thing, the yellow and red flames brightening the dark interior of the shelter, the happy crackle of the dry wood as it burned, that he could not leave it. He went to the trees and brought in as many dead limbs as he could chop off and carry. And when he had a large pile of them, he sat near the fire, though it was getting into the warm middle part of the day, and he was hot, and broke them in small pieces and fed the fire. "I will not let you go out," he said to himself, "to the flames, not ever." And so he sat through a long part of the day, keeping the flames even, eating from his stock of raspberries, leaving to drink from the lake when he was thirsty. In the afternoon, toward evening, with his face smoke-smeared and his skin red from the heat, he finally began to think ahead to what he needed to do. He would need a large woodpile to get through the night. It would be almost impossible to find wood in the dark, so he had to have it all in and cut and stacked before the sun went down. Brian made certain the fire was banked with new wood, then went out of the shelter and searched for a good fuel supply. Up the hill from the campsite, the same windstorm that left him a place to land the plane— had that only been 3-4 days ago, had dropped 3 large white pines across each other. They were dead now, dry and filled with weathered, dry, dead limbs, enough for many days. He chopped and broke and carried wood back to the camp, stacking the pieces under the overhang until he had what he thought to be an enormous pile, as high as his head and 6 feet across the base. Between trips, he added small pieces to the fire to keep it going, and on one of the trips to get wood, he noticed an added advantage of the fire. When he was in the shade of the trees breaking limbs, the mosquitoes swarmed on him, as usual. But when he came to the fire, or just near the shelter where the smoke eddied and swirled, the insects were gone. It was a wonderful discovery. The mosquitoes had nearly driven him mad, and the thought of being rid of them lifted his spirits. On another trip, he looked back and saw the smoke curling up through the trees and realized for the first time that he now had the means to make a signal. He could carry a burning stick and build a signal fire on top of the rock, make clouds of smoke and perhaps attract attention, which meant more wood and still more wood. There did not seem to be an end to the wood he would need, and he spent all the rest of the afternoon into dusk making wood trips. At dark, he settled in again for the night, next to the fire, with the stack of short pieces ready to put on, and he ate the rest of the raspberries. During all the work of the day, his leg had loosened, but it still ached a bit, and he rubbed it and watched the fire and thought for the first time since the crash that he might be getting a handle on things, might be starting to do something other than just sit. He was out of food, but he could look tomorrow, and he could build a signal fire tomorrow and get more wood tomorrow. The fire cut the night coolness and settled him back into sleep, thinking of tomorrow. He slept hard and wasn't sure what awakened him, but his eyes came open and he stared into the darkness. The fire had burned down and looked out, but he stirred with a piece of wood and found a bed of coals still glowing hot and red. With small pieces of wood and careful blowing, he soon had a blaze going again. It had been close. He had to be sure to try and sleep in short intervals so he could keep the fire going. And he tried to think of a way to regulate his sleep, but it made him sleepy to think about it. And he was just going under again when he heard the sound outside. It was not unlike the sound of the porcupine, something slithering and being dragged across the sand. But when he looked out the door opening, it was too dark to see anything. Whatever it was, it stopped making that sound in a few moments, and he thought he heard something sloshing into the water at the shoreline. But he had the fire now and plenty of wood, so he wasn't as worried as he had been the night before. He dozed, slept for a time, awakened again just at dawn gray light, and added wood to the still smoking fire before standing outside and stretching. Standing with his arms stretched over his head and the tight knot of hunger in his stomach, he looked toward the lake and saw the tracks. They were strange, a main center line up from the lake in the sand with claw marks to the side, leading to a small pile of sand, then going back down to the water. He walked over and squatted near them, studied them, tried to make sense of them. Whatever had made the tracks had some kind of flat, dragging bottom in the middle and was apparently pushed along by the legs that stuck out to the side. Up from the water to a small pile of sand, then back down into the water. Some animal. Some kind of water animal that came up to the sand to do what? To do something with the sand. To play and make a pile in the sand? He smiled. City boy, he thought. Oh, you city boy with your city ways. He made a mirror in his mind, a mirror of himself, and saw how he must look. City boy with your city ways, sitting in the sand, trying to read the tracks and not knowing, not understanding. Why would anything wild come up from the water to play in the sand? Not that way. Animals weren't that way. They didn't waste time that way. It had come up from the water for a reason, a good reason, and he must try to understand the reason. He must change to fully understand the reason himself, or he would not make it. It had come up from the water for a reason, and the reason, he thought, squatting, the reason had to do with the pile of sand. He brushed the top off gently with his hand, but found only damp sand. Still, there must be a reason, and he carefully kept scraping and digging until about 4 inches down he suddenly came into a small chamber in the cool, damp sand, and there lay eggs, many eggs, almost perfectly round eggs the size of table tennis balls, and he laughed then because he knew. It had been a turtle. He had seen a show on television about sea turtles that came up onto beaches and laid their eggs in the sand. There must be freshwater lake turtles that did the same. Maybe snapping turtles. He had heard of snapping turtles. They became fairly large, he thought. It must have been a snapper that came up in the night when he heard the noise that awakened him. She must have come then and laid the eggs. Food. More than eggs. More than knowledge. More than anything, this was food. His stomach tightened and rolled and made noise as he looked at the eggs, as if his stomach belonged to somebody else or had seen the eggs with its own eyes and was demanding food. The hunger, always there, had been somewhat controlled and dormant when there was nothing to eat. But with the eggs came the scream to eat. His whole body craved food with such an intensity that it quickened his breath. He reached into the nest and pulled the eggs out one at a time. There were 17 of them, each as round as a ball and white. They had leathery shells that gave instead of breaking when he squeezed them. When he had them heaped on the sand in a pyramid, he had never felt so rich somehow. He suddenly realized that he did not know how to eat them. He had a fire, but no way to cook them, no container, and he had never thought of eating a raw egg. He had an uncle named Carter, his father's brother, who always put an egg in a glass of milk and drank it in the morning. Brian had watched him do it once, just once, and when the runny part of the white left the glass and went into his uncle's mouth and down the throat in a single gulp, Brian almost lost everything he had ever eaten. Still, he thought, still. As his stomach moved toward his backbone, he became less and less fussy. Some natives in the world ate grasshoppers and ants, and if they could do that, he could get a raw egg down. He picked one up and tried to break the shell and found it surprisingly tough. Finally, using the hatchet, he sharpened a stick and poked a hole in the egg. He widened the hole with his finger and looked inside. Just an egg. It had a dark yellow yolk and not so much white as he thought there would be. Just an egg. Food. Just an egg he had to eat. Raw. He looked out across the lake and brought the egg to his mouth and closed his eyes and sucked and squeezed the egg at the same time and swallowed as fast as he could. Yuck! It had a greasy, almost oily taste, but it was still an egg. His throat tried to throw it back up. His whole body seemed to convulse with it, but his stomach took it, held it, and demanded more. The second egg was easier, and by the third one he had no trouble at all. It just slid down. He ate six of them. Could have easily eaten all of them and not been full, but a part of him said to hold back, save the rest. He could not now believe the hunger. The eggs had awakened it fully, roaringly, so that it tore at him. After the sixth egg, he ripped the shell open and licked the inside clean, then went back and ripped the other five open and licked them out as well, and wondered if he could eat the shells. There must be some food value in them, but when he tried, they were too leathery to chew, and he couldn't get them down. He stood away from the eggs for a moment, literally stood and turned away so that he could not see them. If he looked at them, he would have to eat more. He would store them in the shelter and eat only one a day. He fought the hunger down again, controlled it. He would take them now and store them and save them and eat one a day, and he realized as he thought it that he had forgotten that they might come. The searchers. Surely they would come before he could eat all the eggs at one a day. He had forgotten to think about them, and that wasn't good. He had to keep thinking of them, because if he forgot them and did not think of them, they might forget about him. And he had to keep hoping. He had to keep hoping. There were these things to do. He transferred all the eggs from the small beach into the shelter, reburying them near his sleeping area. It took all his will to keep them from eating another one as he moved them, but he got it done. And when they were out of sight again, it was easier. He added wood to the fire and cleaned up the camp area. A good laugh, that, cleaning the camp. All he did was shake out his windbreaker and hang it in the sun to dry the berry juice that had soaked in and smooth the sand where he slept. But it was a mental thing. He had gotten depressed thinking about how they hadn't found him yet, and when he was busy and had something to do, the depression seemed to leave. So there were things to do. With the camp squared away, he brought in more wood. He had decided to always have enough on hand for 3 days, and after spending one night with the fire for a friend, he knew what a staggering amount of wood it would take. He worked all through the morning at the wood, breaking down dead limbs and breaking or chopping them in smaller pieces, storing them neatly beneath the overhang. He stopped once to take a drink at the lake, and in his reflection, he saw that the swelling on his head was nearly gone. There was no pain there, so he assumed that had taken care of itself. His leg was also back to normal, although he had a small pattern of holes, roughly star-shaped, where the quills had nailed him. And while he was standing at the lake shore taking stock, he noticed that his body was changing. He had never been fat, but he had been slightly heavy, with a little extra weight just above his belt at the sides. This was completely gone, and his stomach had caved into the hunger and the sun had cooked him past burning, so he was tanning, and with the smoke from the fire his face was starting to look like leather. But perhaps more than his body was the change in his mind, or in the way he was becoming. I'm not the same, he thought. I see, I hear differently. He did not know when the change started, but it was there. When a sound came to him now, he didn't just hear it, but would know the sound. He would swing and look at it, a breaking twig, a movement of air, and know the sound as if he somehow could move his mind back down the wave of sound to the source. He could know what the sound was before he quite realized he had heard it. And when he saw something, a bird moving a wing inside a bush or a ripple on the water, he would truly see that